Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Say that again.
So did you see Alex in it?
Yeah, I did.
He's pretty big too. He's very tall.
He's pretty big, yeah. No way his bio says 6'2". Like, there's no way he's 6'2". Must have thrown that in there when he was like 13, because he's like at least 2 or 3 inches tall than that for sure.
I remember seeing Medvedev and Bublik, and those guys are so big. Medvedev is a tower. Like, he's in...
Oh yeah. I mean, his hands are like 3 times my size. Yeah, that way you grip the racket with those hands.
Exactly. It has like custom made handles that are like,
yeah,
like a foot long Subway.
Yeah, I feel like we see the numbers on TV and we see like 6'5", and it's like, oh, that's not as tall as John Isner. But then you walk past them and it's like they're 2 heads taller than you. It's like, oh my God.
Hey, friends, welcome to the Tennis Amigos podcast. This is the official intro. Owen is yawning.
Dang. I forgot it was video too.
We're tired, and that's the problem. I'm very tired too. I just no show, and I'm just kidding. But yeah, it's a special podcast. Like, it's the first one since probably January after Steve Blink in Australia. After that, we had the Golden Swing in Latin America, and then before or around the same time, we had European indoors. First phase, then the next one's gonna be October or whatever, and then we had 2 WTA 1000s, which we did not cover, but also we were all very tired and Bunch was very busy because he's now working at Tennis One. More on that to follow later. And Owen and I was just basically a little burnt out. Like, it's just, I guess, too much tennis is a thing. I guess it kind of happened. I don't say I barely watched Indian Wells, but I didn't watch it as much as I would have like in the past. I was following the draws and the scores, but I think the one who is going to be able to add most to this conversation is Bunch on that regard. And it clicked back on and during Miami. So I am kind of fresh. I liked watching Miami, and I'm actually very excited for the clay season. Also, more on that to come later in the episode. But first of all, how are you guys doing? Owen's very tired. I know that.
I'll let Bunch go first.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a while since I've been on one of these. You know, I was just thinking, like, probably like end of last year, beginning of this year, I was doing those with Steve, but also with you, Andre, in like November. And so, yeah, it's been a long time. I've been busy, as most of you know, with like the Tennis One app. So I've been helping them a lot with all the like digital stuff and content, and been on site for a couple of tournaments, mostly San Diego and Miami. I was just there for almost 2 weeks. So it's been cool to get a little bit of the behind the scenes access, get to talk to some more players, get like practice footage, match footage, and just like, you know, help try to bring something different to the game. So that's what I've been busy with. And so now I'm just back from Miami and just sort of ready to crash. But I'm really excited for the clay season and what's coming ahead with, Monte Carlo all the way to Roland Garros, basically.
Vance, will tennis fans get to like see what you've been working on if they download the Tennis One app? And where can they do that?
Yeah, wow. You're just setting me up for some really nice, you know, business promo here, Owen. Thank you so much. No, I mean, yeah, you can download the Tennis One app. It's available on the App Store. We can actually provide the link in the description to this show as well for you guys. Make it even easier for you. How about that? And, you know, you download the Tennis One app and you can find all the information you need on all the coverage happening on both tours, you know, Challenger Tour, ATP WTA Tour. We got you all covered with that. Score, stats, news, videos. You can also check out the videos that I make, which are like contest matchup preview videos. So if you're going into a match and you're like, oh, I really want to know like what's going to happen between Ons Jabeur and Daniel Collins, well, guess what? I probably have a matchup preview for that coming your way. And I probably will pick on something specific, like who's going to hit more aces, who's going to win more games, who's going to win more break points, And there's these contests in the app that you can create, but you can challenge your friends to them, and you can earn, you know, a good like 5 to 10 bucks every day just doing that. And it's a really cool feature. It's something new that we've added in the app. So for all of those in the US where you know, it's legal skills-based gaming, then you can go ahead and play them. And I'm pretty sure it's available in like 30 out of 50 states. So yeah, that's
And
I don't
the really great news is like there are no like gambling scandals at all right now, like in sports, right? Like
No, not at all. And
it's
the
such a
best part about
clean
this, Owen,
industry.
is that it's not gambling. That's the
All
best part about it.
right.
It's skills-based gaming. Let's go, you know?
Yeah.
There you go. There you go. It's but yeah, it's Vont, it's really cool that you're like in tennis this much, because I feel like a lot of the time we're not to like dunk on any tennis media people in particular, but like people go to these tournaments and are like, I feel like fans could do a better job than some of these people. And now it's really cool that someone who's like as dedicated and like well read about the sport as you is like at these tournaments on the ground. So I'm really happy for you about that.
Well, yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. I'll try to do as much as I can whenever I get a chance to go on site.
Yeah, I mean, I was just we were just joking like before we started that like Bunch just basically switched from doing this for fun to being paid to do this, because he basically is doing things, the same thing that he's always done, like on Twitter. If you follow to one of his like what 15,000 followers now or something, Bunch has been yeah has been always doing stats and crazy things, and now he's just posting them on, you know, Tennis One, and that's a great gig to have. Well, not gig, but like an actual cool job to do. So yeah. And if Tennis One is looking for an official podcast, if you don't already have one, if you have one, well, yeah, probably better. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, we're available, I guess. So yeah, if we could, Bunch can pass it up for senior management or something. Another joke that was bad, but whatever. Indian Wells, that's the first leg of the Sunshine Double. Let's just touch in a little bit on that one, shall we? Indian Wells, always the classic. Completely, you know, off the left field, like a hardcore tournament, if you will. Like it doesn't feel like a hardcore, doesn't play like a hardcore, and has the best scenery in all. Well, probably one of the like at least top three, five best sceneries in all the world in tennis tournaments. Tennis players love it. Always gets voted as the best tournament in the world. Like, what do you think? What are your guys' thoughts on this tournament, the champions Alcaraz and Iga Swiatek? How many times have they ever like won the same tournament in the same week? Why don't you know that? I think it's weird that.
Actually, their sixth time having won a title at the same week. Is it the third time in the same like venue because of the combined events? So, like they won Miami in 2022, they won the US Open in 2022, and also they've now won Indian Wells together. But it was a big story because Alcaraz hadn't won a title since Wimbledon. Everyone was, you know, overreacting and was like, oh my gosh, you know, he's never gonna win anything again. No, I'm kidding. But like, you know, some people were like worried about him because he's like in a slump. And you know, for him, like I guess quarters and semis is a slump. So I guess, you know, but being back at Indian Wells, I feel like that court suits him really nicely, you know, with the high bounce and like his kick serve works really good on it. And it just gives him more time to set up and just use his like creativity, his shot making, just like, you know, overpower you with forehands basically anywhere. And you're kind of toast when he has time on that shot. So I feel like it was a really good healing week for Alcaraz to just, you know, get back into it. And, you know, he won against Sinner, he won against Medvedev. So he got a leg up on his rivals there at least. And I feel like these courts are going to be great conditions for him for his whole career. And he's already won two Indian Wells titles at 20. So I think it's a great venue. And it's kind of similar for Iga as well. So that's why another plug, you got to check out the Iga and Carlos tennis show that I host with Damien. Because yeah, we talk about this stuff a lot in terms of the parallels between them. And also just, yeah, we try to cover both the tours and them and their results and where they kind of fit into the whole landscape. So yeah.
Did you catch any of oh, go on.
No, go ahead, Andre.
No, I was gonna ask you, Owen, if you how much have you watched of Indian Wells, or your thoughts maybe even on Alcaraz and Swiatek on their successes there.
Yeah, so I did catch a decent part of it, and I think my lasting impression of that tournament is going to be the Alcaraz Sinner semifinal, because you know, that was by beating Sinner, Alcaraz kind of ended Sinner's was it 17 matches in a row, Bunch?
16, I believe, but yeah, you're right.
16, gotcha. Yeah, and I think the way he did it was super interesting, and kind of speaks to what you said earlier about this court suiting him so well. Because in the first set, Sinner looks like a god and just completely blasted him off the court. And I am really curious about both your thoughts on this, because in the second two sets, Alcaraz did what everyone on Twitter was telling him to do. and slowed down the pace, varied his spins, kind of, you know, everyone's favorite tennis Twitter troll slash intellectual Caleb said that Sinner's forehand is like perfect as a sledgehammer, but like unfamiliar as a scalpel. And I thought that kind of summed it up perfectly because Sinner's forehand completely like short circuited in the last set and a half. So I'm kind of curious on you guys' thoughts. Like, did Alcaraz unlock something there that is going to work against Sinner in the future? Or did Sinner just have a really bad forehand performance for half the match that was possibly influenced by like a wrist injury that he picked up?
I think to Alcaraz's credit, he actually made that adjustment really nicely towards the beginning of the second set because he and I guess Ferrero, you know, together were like, you know, we're not going to win this match just going toe to toe with Sinner from the baseline and just exchanging body blows because that's only usually going to go one way. And with Sinner's really great stroke production on both sides, it's going to be really tough for Alcaraz to not get rushed on the first ball. So he's like, okay, I will mix in my backhand slice. I will mix in the higher loopier forehands and get the ball out of Sinner's strike zone where maybe he has to like generate from a really high contact point or a really low one and just keep him kind of guessing. And the drop shot slices variety is something Sinner's worked a ton on in his game and he's gotten way better at now. But still, for when you combine that with Alcaraz's power, and I felt like his serving went up and I just felt like he got more relaxed into the match and started like actually enjoying that whole process of feeling like a weight was lifted off his shoulder when he got, you know, kind of like in the Wimbledon final when he lost that first set 6-1, sometimes it just kind of frees you up when you have four or five bad games in a row like that to like, you kind of have to try something different or you're toast. So I feel like Alcaraz had a really good mindset there. I think the second set was actually the best set of the match. Third set was a little disappointing because Sinner got hurt. And like, I guess, what you know, after Alcaraz got that break, it was tough for Sinner. Like, you know, physically, I didn't think he was 100%. But nonetheless, I thought Alcaraz like maintained a pretty high level.
Well, that stabbed volley when he was like on the stretch like that made it all worth it right there.
Yeah, that was the best point of the third set. But I will say the most important point of the match was actually 5-3, 30-40 in the second set when Alcaraz came up with this really brilliant backhand on the line. It was like kind of low margin, but my goodness, like he went full throttle on it and it was perfectly placed in the corner.
Yeah, and I want to give a little shout out to the set point in the second set as well, because on that point, Sinner hit one of those kind of trademark running forehands cross court, buries it in the corner, but Alcaraz gets it back. And then, you know, Sinner's way behind the baseline and the first chance he gets, Alcaraz just floats that drop shot into the open space. So I thought that was... And I think that to me is like the deadliest Alcaraz on a slow court, right? Like he gives himself time to defend and then like lets that drop shot loose when the opponent is out of position. I think he's pretty close to unplayable when he's like really in the groove doing that.
Yeah. So like giving the results, I think fair to say also Sinner just went on and won the Miami next week in a pretty dominant fashion, like over like sort of the final few rounds, like beating Medvedev, and most notably a 6-2, 6-1. Not that Medvedev played much of his best match of his life, but it wasn't necessarily like... Well, Sinner also played phenomenally, so let's just put it this way. And he also went on to beat Grigor Dimitrov, like kind of a good story of the week, only on the men's side. 6-3, 6-1, 6-0, 6-3, something like that. But he was also another pretty dominant match. But I guess seeing like Alcaraz's and Sinner's, Alcaraz a little bit more from like last year and 2022, and Sinner now this year, what do you think has like the highest peak of these two? Like it's definitely a question that we're probably going to be like asking ourselves, as they are probably going to meet in more matches this year, hopefully at the very least.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like six or 7 months ago, you would have said Alcaraz is way ahead, and he's kind of, you know, and Sinner is still has a lot of improvements to make, and you know, look at his head to heads versus everyone else, and it seemed like every time he faced Alcaraz, he was like a god, right? But then it didn't always like translate because his physical durability wasn't always there. His serve wasn't the weapon that it is now. But actually, now that Sinner is really caught up and he's won all these matches post U.S. Open, I think like 42-3, something crazy, like since the U.S. Open ended, and now like 22-1 this year, and like he has a real shot to finish this year number one if he keeps continuing like this. I guess the biggest question for Sinner is the clay season, you know, because that's like the one part of the calendar where we haven't seen him like peak yet. I guess like when he first broke out, he made the Roland Garros quarters, and like last year he had some good results, like Monte Carlo, he got to the semis and probably should have won that match against Rona, but But like this year, now that he has all those tools, like I'm very curious to see how it plays out, because I feel like on faster surfaces, I might give a slight edge to Sinner when they play it, but then on the slower courts like Indian Wells, or like if they play during the clay season, you'd probably have to give a slight edge to Alcaraz. But I think it could go pretty back and forth. I feel like their rivalry could be like, it's 4-4 right now, but I feel like it could be like 12-12, 15-15, like assuming they're just going to play each other 20, 30 times. Like it is, they are just going to go back and forth like that. And that's so exciting for tennis. And I feel like these two are like, yeah, kind of head and shoulders going to be like, you know, maybe they're definitely the leaders of the next generation for sure. But like, yeah, I don't know. Like maybe Alcaraz's peak level is like, he's going to have some days where his creativity and his like Indian Wells type form is just too much for Sinner. But I feel like Sinner is much more percentage tennis space. You know, he's like much more like maybe a bit overall more consistent over a larger period of time in matches. And perhaps he's just not going to beat himself as much. Whereas Alcaraz is more like a shot maker, extravagant a little bit. So he's going to want to play like some certain shots sometimes to please the crowds or just kind of get his joy back in the game, where Sinner's not going to really care about that. He's just going to play really high percentage, big hitting tennis on both sides and just take care of business. And yeah, it's working really well for him.
Yeah, that's a great assessment. I agree that I think Alcaraz's peak is just that little bit higher because he can,
yeah,
like he's got the touch. He's a little bit faster. Like he has a drop shot. It's better in net, but it's so close. And like you said, Vaughn, like when they just exchange pace, like Sinner is better, right? Like that doesn't go well for Alcaraz. And it's so funny because the comparison that always jumps into my head is you know, apologies if this is a little PG-13, but it's like Alcaraz doesn't want to make it like a dick measuring contest, right? Because he goes in and it's like, I have a better forehand than you, so I'm just gonna blast it. And he ignores the fact that the first set of Indian Wells, and he got blown out like 6-1. I kind of think it's sort of like what Federer would do with Del Potro sometimes. Like Federer would he would think like, I have a better forehand and I'm gonna prove that. And it's like, yeah, you probably do, but you're gonna let the opponent do what they're best at if you try to exchange forehands that way. So you're gonna really let them shine, and what you want to do is like mix pace and attack their weakness. And so I think that yeah, Vanja, I agree with you. Like when Alcaraz like lets himself defend like that, he's got the variety going. I do think he's a little bit better. But you're also right. Like Sinner's the in-form player, right? Like Alcaraz isn't on a winning streak like this. Sinner has even when Alcaraz was like way better than Sinner in terms of achievements, like before Sinner won a major, the head-to-head was always pretty close. So I think it's a great matchup. And what I'm most curious about right now is how is Sinner going to respond to what Alcaraz did in Indian Wells? Because I think if you're cynical as hell, and also like really prone to recency bias as I am, you look at that and you're like, well, Sinner's going to beat 99% of players because he's just that good, but he didn't have an adjustment, right? Like he, once Alcaraz started doing that, Sinner didn't really have anything for him. So that's what I'm most curious about, right? Like what is Sinner going to do? Like if his forehand just can't murder those loopy balls the way it can murder like a flat hard ball, what's his adjustment going to be? And I think the only way that either guy can kind of go on a run in the head-to-head is if like something happens that they don't have an adjustment for. Like for a while, Alcaraz was just hell-bent on exchanging pace with Sinner, and he lost a couple in a row. But now he has this adjustment, and I think he could win a couple in a row. And I think they're going to keep making each other better and better.
Yeah, for sure. Another thing I'll probably add is that Sinner's serve, his spot serving. I think he definitely has an edge over Alcaraz in that department right now. That's the one area of Alcaraz's game that I could point to right now and be like, Alcaraz can hit 130, 135 regularly, but he just can't, you know, he can't place it on a dime the way Sinner can right now with his really fluid motion and like the changes he's made, but also like it's just very reliable, that delivery, whereas, you know, Alcaraz can sometimes get beat on a fast hard court when he's just kind of serving directly into the strike zone. And so that's probably one area where I would say Sinner certainly has that leg up, but that's what makes the clay season interesting, because that's where the serve is less of a factor, like overall. So then all that baseline variety and all of that stuff that comes much more naturally for Alcaraz, it's kind of innate for him. For Sinner, he's had to work on it and it's still developing. Mm-hmm. So, but other than that, I feel like Sinner, there's no real, like, it's become very Djokovic-like. You look at his game in terms of, there's no real like hole, there's no real weakness where you can like attack him, you know, right now, because he's just defending at such a great level. Mm-hmm. Like the classic shots he was hitting against Dimitrov, I felt sorry for Grigor because he was doing everything you would ask for him. You know, he was hitting really good forehand approaches. He was serving really well. He was, you know, for the most part hanging, but he just couldn't. He just couldn't compete with Sinner's, like, you know, ability to like convert defense to offense and like the way that Djokovic is able to do.
Yeah, I saw a few of the highlights of them. Actually, I wasn't able to watch the final, and partially because it ended a little bit too quickly. So when I got home, it was already over. But also because, well, I was away, but like I was watching some of the highlights, and I thought, like, well, did Grigor like not play the lights out tennis that he was playing like the week? Sure, like his level was probably not as good as when he played Alcaraz, but he kept it pretty high when he played Zverev. Like I think he was able to like mix up his things and just you know, stay with him. Like when he lost, I think he lost the second set. As soon as he lost the tiebreak, I thought, well, this is probably over for him. I think he's gonna like mentally
that win.
That one
actually impressed me even more than the Alcaraz win.
Oh yeah, like, that was so good.
Alcaraz was like the match of his life, and he could put no foot wrong, and it was just him, just like a very different tactic. But against Zverev, like when he lost that second set, and also given that Zverev had beaten him 7 times in a row, you kind of thought like, man,
it's in his head.
Zverev, he was more consistent than him. Like he hit his forehand way better than Zverev did. And like later down the stretch, he was just a more courageous and more brave player under pressure. And that was like really impressive, because you would think after the Alcaraz match, maybe he'd have a little bit of a letdown. Maybe Zverev was just going to be too good for him from the baseline and from the serve. And that didn't happen like for the first time. And like Grigor was so clever the way he was using his backhand slice and making Zverev hit those forehands that were pretty tame from him. And like then Grigor could really get back. It was so great. And there was that volley that he hit on the break point in the third set where he was just on the ground. And he had to improvise at the last second. And the whole stadium just erupted at that point. So
I love that point because he played everything well in that point. Even if he hadn't had to do the crazy volley, that he would have had that point regardless. Maybe the passing shot was low, so it would have been difficult. But like the entire point, he played amazing. Like just attacking tennis from start to finish. Like he didn't, a lot of the times in Grigor's career, he was wasting a little bit of time by like not hitting the attacking shot when he should have. And this tournament, he did it everything right, in my opinion. Even against Sinner, he did so many things right. It was just Sinner on the other side of the net. He couldn't really compete against him. He wasn't able to consistently keep up like the aggression, and made a few errors like on and when serving. And some of the games are even close. Like it was like a 40-30 and like a 30-40. You know, he wasn't necessarily blown off the court as the score suggests as much. Like I saw like some of his backhand winners down the line that he wasn't really afraid of hitting. It was just going down the line as soon as he got the chance. Sinner was just defending like crazy. And it was just like, it was really great. I think you pointed out like how he was doing like Djokovic. Like his open stance backhand, like from the back of the court defending, was just like, what the hell? Like, what do you do? It's just, you cannot even be ready for it. Like specifically, you have to be in a sort of like mental space where Federer at his peak was like, lunging like for his volleys and like just being able to kind of like foresee the future. Like this, it was like 3 seconds that I just like, I'm just know he's gonna go down the line instead. It was just there, but like he would still need to be at that level to do something about it.
It's such a crazy shot, and like I hate to talk about myself, but I played tennis last night for the first time in a really long time, and I was playing this guy, and I hit a forehand down the line that like clips the sideline, right? And so I'm thinking like, okay, better approach, because like I like go to net, because you're never gonna hit a better approach than this. And and the guy I was playing hits like a backhand down the line like past me, and I was just like, what the hell? Like it was like in my head it was almost like the banana backhand. It almost certainly didn't look that good, because like, you know, I suck at tennis. But it was like you said, Andre, you can't defend it. But yeah, I think another comparison I kind of hate to make, but like with Dimitrov playing so well, and like you beat Alcaraz, and then you beat another top player like really impressively, only to get crushed in the final by like the other top guy. Like it's a little bit of shades of like the big three, right? Like you take out like a top seed, like generational talent, mm-hmm. in like your finals. And that just doesn't get you shit. Like it gets you 2 more rounds, but then like run into the other one in the final. And like, unless it's like, you know, the best tournament of your life, you're not. And maybe this was up there for Dimitrov. Like you can't do it twice. You know, you can't beat them both. Like one of them is going to peak and beat you. And it's just I felt bad for the guy, and I'm glad he got his flowers for playing so well in Miami. But I was so like, man, I was rooting for him to win that final, and I. I was sad that he lost that decisively, but it's like, yeah, this is what happens when you have like, when the top of the tour is that strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, I loved his response whenever he was asked in the press conference about the big three, because, you know, rather than spinning it as like a negative thing, like, oh, I could have won so much more when I was playing alongside these guys, because he did play them a ton, and he did, to his credit, beat them at least one time, at least. And so that's an achievement in its own right. And like, he knows that it was so tough for him to win titles. But like, now he goes through this era and he's like, guess what, guys? I went through that 10 years ago. I can kind of do anything now. And I feel that, and I feel like he spun that into a positive in a way that I feel like, even though he's number 9 in the world and he was number 3 in 2017, this is the best I've ever seen him play in terms of putting wins together, like consecutive top 10 wins like this. And also just the clarity that he has in his game. I mean, like that Alcaraz match, I could easily make a case that was the best match he's played from start to finish in a best of three set match, like ever.
Yeah.
Like just, you know, just, and it felt like kind of clear in his game plan. Like he knew he couldn't just hang back from the back of the court and slice backhands all day against Alcaraz's pace. So he's like, I'm just going to play proactively and just go for the kill, like right off the first ball. It kind of reminded me of like Federer when he aged like past 35 and when he was
putting it down. Nail backhand.
Well, that reminded me so much of that match, just the score line, but also just this kind of style of opponents and the game plan that he had. He's really like simplified things with Jamie Delgado and mostly with Jamie in his corner. And like, he just feels like he has a ton more clarity in terms of, because he's always had all the shots. He's always had the amazing athleticism. He's always kind of had the full package, but now he's really starting to put it together. Is he going to win a major? Probably not, but at least, you know, like, can he get to another quarter semi? Like, it's certainly possible now. You know, I certainly believe he can continue to have more runs like this for the next 18 months or 2 years, maybe.
He's only 32, right?
Yeah.
I thought he was older than that, seriously. I thought he was like 34.
Fit. Like, he's so fit. So hopefully he can be like that. He had some rough years after the 2017 thing. He had long COVID, which really messed with his training, and he had like some shoulder issues. Like, you know, that 2019 US Open really kind of saved him. Otherwise, he really would have been playing challengers. So to like see a guy like get back to this level now, work like over 5.5 years, and now he's back in the top 10, like, he's really, really earned this. So I was so happy for him, even though he lost that final.
Yeah, it's I think the legend thing that you mentioned, like, oh, he played against big three and stuff. I think it's great for him to still be playing and recognize something like that. Like, it means that like he kind of still can appreciate if he ever runs into Djokovic again, for example, who's still playing. Still kind of need to see a little bit like where he's at after Australian Open loss, and then after like Indian Wells loss as well. There's like kind of like, we just don't really even have like enough like of a sample size to judge Djokovic's 2024 season yet. But like, still number one, mostly just for tournaments. Like, not necessarily it's like in a 52-week, not the race, but it's kind of interesting to see like what happens during a clay season. But in terms of playing the legends, I mean, now that you know all the things that they did, like to be able to tell everybody, hey, I was playing alongside these guys. I've met them, like on all of them, like on in the locker room. I beat them like a couple times, even like whether it's on the women's side as well, like against Serena. It's like, oh man, like I was just like walking alongside a living legend. And like having the time of my life. I got beaten several times. Like, she got to win a lot of the things, but you know, I was part of that story. So I feel like it's a really amazing thing, like no matter how you spin it. So you could have won more titles, but like, who cares? Like, I mean, he's still pretty successful regardless. He won the second highest tier of tournaments that exist, which is the ATP finals. He won Cincinnati. So like he got to number 3 in the world. Like, see, he did the whole thing. Like, basically the only thing that he didn't really do was like win a major. But like, I mean, so many other players didn't win a major, and so few actually win a major, that when you look at that, like measuring his success in the career, when you cut the big three out of the equation, like, he's pretty out there, like in terms of like one of the most successful players of his generation.
I think he's made semis or better at 8 out of the 9 Masters 1000s. Yeah. So, and he's made quarters at all of them, and like basically apart from Roland Garros and like one of the other Masters, like Madrid, he's been to the semifinals of every other big tournament. So
even Roland Garros, he's part of a legendary moment when he was playing Richard Gasquet, and they had like a three-shot rally, and Gasquet puked and Dimitrov started cramping. It was kind of combination, really impressive and like a little bit hilarious to watch. I think Greg Orkin put that on his resume. So
is the moment.
But
he said once that he played, this is a funny anecdote from the press conference. He said, you know, he was asked like who was the toughest out of the three. He said like for him it was Roger, and he felt like when he played Roger at Wimbledon, he wanted to go dig himself into a hole and just hide.
Yeah.
Felt so embarrassed being on the court and with Fed in 2017. Everyone in the press room was laughing.
And it makes sense because like the 2017 Wimbledon, like this is Dimitrov's best year. Yeah. He has this amazing Australian Open. And I think I kind of remember like looking up the score line at the time and being like, what the hell? That was supposed to be like way closer. Federer just like blew him off the court.
Yeah, 2017 is like after 06, 07, probably one of the best season of his life, seriously. Like the way he came out of that backhand or save. What about the women guy? Like, what do you feel like? I feel like one of the stories of Indian Wells, like, we're going to get to Danielle Collins later in a little bit, but like, Rhea Sakkari, like, really impressed me in Indian Wells, right? I mean, she really does. I think, well, she put a lot of, you put her like in a match when she's behind, she's extremely dangerous. When she's ahead, you can kind of get shaky. But I think that's basically the start of her whole career in a sense, right? Like now there's like very little pressure on her in a sense. Like people are not really expecting her to reach the final again. And then she...
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
She beat a few great players on the way to losing to Świątek again in the final, but it's pretty inspiring run, I'd say, for her.
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned her. Like, she was at the one of my top of my list when we were going to talk about the women, because she also made quarters of Miami, played this really good match against Rybakina, which I was there for in the stadium, and probably maybe the best match of the whole week, to be honest. It was so well fought from both. And like in Indian Wells, I love the conditions for her because like she's such a muscular, physically gifted player. So I feel like the conditions at Indian Wells, she can hit through that court. And it just gives her a little bit more time, clarity. She'd been to the final already in 2022, made the semis last year. So it's a really consistent tournament for her. And like now she has a new coach, David Witt, who was with Pegula for 5 years, coached Venus Williams before that. And they're kind of a yin and yang combination because Sakkari is super tense and she gets stressed. And like in big moments, she kind of needs someone to like, you know, calm her down and just let her know that everything's okay. And I feel like David Witt is kind of that guy in her corner that just simplifies things for her. So I think part of that is also the case. I was very impressed with the win over Coco Gauff in the semis because she was up 6-4, 5-2, and she was just overpowering Coco. And Coco was having all kinds of trouble with her serve and her forehand. And you thought, okay, this is really going to be it. Like Coco can't really get back into this match. And then all of a sudden, Maria tightens up a little bit. Coco starts hitting it through her forehand with a lot more pace and starts hitting a bit more higher, loopier, which is probably what she had to do from the start of the match. But anyway, she gets back into it. And then now you're thinking, oh my goodness, Sakkari just lost that set from two breaks up and she served for it twice. How in the world is she going to regroup and win this third set? And then she just plays an amazing third set where she just lets it free completely. And like I love seeing that from her because like often I feel like she gets a lot of hate online for no reason because she hasn't won like a title in whatever X number of years or like her semis record or her finals record. But honestly, like she's super resilient and she's really like put in the work and you can kind of see that she's like improved her mental side to a point where like she's always going to be in the conversation. Like if you take out the top four players on the WTA with like your, you know, Iga, Rina, Lena and Coco to some extent, then she's like one of the best of the rest after that. So I was really glad to see her back it up in Miami on a completely different surface. And just, I feel like the clay season could be big for her. She's just waiting for that major run because all the majors she's played since the French Open and US Open in 2021 have been pretty disappointing for her. She's had a couple of tough draws, like Mukhova twice at Roland Garros, that's really rough. But like, yeah, she's one of those players that you really root for.
Yeah, she had a pretty good run, like in Indian Wells. Like just to see the players that she's beaten, just lost her.
Beat Emma Montero as well in the quarters. So it's like,
yeah, she got past Sakkari. I mean, she got past Garcia, and then Navarro, and then Goff, which is like a pretty good list of players like right now specifically.
Yeah. Even the final was pretty competitive for the first set. Like, you know, Iga went up 3-love, and then from then on, I thought from love 3-4-all, it was Sakkari who was the better player, and it was like, oh my gosh, we're gonna have a close final, and then nope, we're not. Iga just runs through the next 8 games, and it was, yeah, oh my goodness, there was nothing she could do in the second set.
I hate to be pessimistic again, but I feel like she's like the kind of the comparison point for like Dimitrov in Miami. Like she did so well that win over Goff, you can't say enough about. Like it's like the Wimbledon 2008 thing, right? Like you get super close to winning in straights, your opponent comes back in like brutal, heartbreaking fashion, and then you close.
Like you choke and you win anyway. Which...
Exactly. That I think that's the hardest thing to do in tennis. Like she, amazing mental strength, and then in the final, like you just run into that player who's just like. Yeah. So much better than you are. Like it's brutal. And I remember watching their Indian Wells final a couple of years ago. And I'm like, I thought Sakkari played pretty well as he got drilled in that one too. And I'm just like, man, like sometimes there's just nothing you can do. And I think it just shows like tennis is just such a hard sport with that. Like those players, like Iga is always gonna be in that Indian Wells final. Like she's always gonna be in the way. And you know, I mean obviously we love Iga, she's great, but from Sakkari, like you said, Bonch, like you root for her. She had this great tournament. She made that first set a battle, and you're right. Like after that four all, even after the way the first set ended, I don't think she did a lot wrong. I think Iga hit a forehand winner down the line on set point, and it's just, you know, what can you do? And then the second set, like Sakkari won like 5 points or something. Like
yeah, 5 points.
It's brutal, and it just makes the. It makes the gap between those two players, even though ranking wise they're not far apart, like so painfully apparent. And so I really hope that she didn't get demoralized by that, because that's just what Iga does at Indian Wells, right? So yeah, amazing tournament from Sakkari. And I think Iga also, you look at Collins, like who won Miami, look at her result against Iga at Indian Wells, 6-3, 6-0. Like, So I think that sometimes you're just going to play these rivals, these players who like they're just going to destroy you, and you just have to be able to take it and come back and beat everyone else just to give yourself that chance to get destroyed again. It's kind of like the guy pushing the boulder up the hill, but it's also like a little bit of the beauty of the sport.
Yeah. And but you mentioned also like Danielle Collins, like I feel like in Miami, there's no question that it was the story of the Sunshine Double, really, like how Danielle Collins just loses the first set that she plays in Miami, and then like wins everything in straights, like just wins all the following sets that she's played. And Rybakina was actually the only player who was able to, well, after losing the first set, to push her into like a best four all, like in the to win more than four games in a set against Collins. She was just playing out of her mind. It was like unbelievable. Like and. The final was like really great as well. I watched a few the last few games, and I was starting to get a little scared, like for her, because she wasn't able to convert like I think like 4 match points. Got into a couple break points as well.
Well, the last game was such an ordeal.
Yeah, but the tennis she played was like, wow, so you know, so brave, like so bold, and just like classic Danielle Collins, just like complaining to her box and just hitting even harder in the next shot. It was crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, it was wild. Like, it seemed like she could do no wrong for, like, 13 sets in the whole tournament. And she came up against really quality players as well. You look at her draw, and it's like, my goodness, how did she do that to Caroline Garcia, who took out Osaka and Goff, and, like, you know, the wins over, like, she beat Alexandrova, like, very handily in the semis. And Alexandrova just beaten Pegula in the quarters and just destroyed Iga in the fourth round. So it was like, whenever she played against big hitters, she even got more clarity and just was, like, attacking second serve returns. It's almost Ostapenko-esque, like, when she's in that zone, because... Like second serve returns, she's like the most aggressive second serve returner, like behind Ostapenko statistically. And it's like, how are you supposed to compete with that on the first strike? And guess what? Like she can actually move really well. She can serve. She has like really like kind of, it seems like a disarming serve, because you feel like, oh, I can attack this, but it's like coming right at you to the body. And it has a little bit of slice on it. So it's like really hard to like get the advantage in the rally, like once you get the serve back even, because sometimes like I feel like she's a little too... what's that word? Like, she tries to end it a bit too quickly, the points, because she feels like she can just play on her terms the whole time. But I feel like this time she actually had a good mix of like staying longer in baseline rallies and like looping the ball up just to give herself more time on her forehand. I feel like the forehand is a weaker wing than her backhand, but my goodness, like when she steps in on that side too, it's like there's just no way to attack her. And then like you add in like the feistiness, the intensity, like the tenacity, like everything that she's known for, she had like a great mix. Like she wasn't just yelling come on after every single point like for most of the tournament, because she was mostly just so focused on like, you know, the next game, next changeover, like next set. But I feel like in the final, that's when you saw like the true Danielle Collins, because she had like the whole crowd behind her. It was like, she said afterwards, it was like playing in front of thousands of my best friends, because it's like her home state, Florida. And she had like her best result 6 years ago. And like, she's gone through like so much with like endometriosis, like rheumatoid arthritis. And like, she has to retire. It's not like, it's not based on her results. Like she just can't like wake out of bed in the morning and walk sometimes, because like she plays fewer tournaments than most of the other players do on the tour because of her health. So like this, like no matter what, I feel like she's not going to change her mind. Like this is her final year, because she wants to potentially have a kid. And, you know, maybe there's a chance 2 or 3 years later that she feels like maybe like a Barty or a Hennin, and is like, okay, I'm retiring right now and I don't enjoy the sport right now, because it's really tough, like the week in, week out grind. But in a couple of years, maybe we'll see. But honestly, like, I think she's just so ready for the next chapter of her life. And I was so glad for the story, because like, she was like, I feel like she's always been really deserving of a big title of some kind. Mm-hmm. She was in the Australian Open final and she pushed Barty really, really hard. And that time she had the crowd against her. Now she has this moment where like she can really just like do her whole career proud. And like, she's only won 3 titles, but a 250, 500,000 and a slam final, like all after playing college tennis and only being on tour for like 5 years and playing like 10 tournaments a year. Like it's amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah. Vaughn, she just made me miss Barty again.
Yeah, I know.
But yeah, I totally agree. And like that last game is just like, I don't know. It's such a feel good moment. Like when, you know, I couldn't even watch it live. I was following the live scores, but it's like just every single person is just willing that tennis player to cross the finish line. And like I think another example was Sabalenka at the last game of the Australian Open last year. And it's like all these championship points, all these break points, all these deuces, and you're just like, oh my god, like I want you to do it so badly. And finally they do, and it just feels incredible for everyone involved. So yeah, I was thrilled for her. And I also wanted to get you guys' thoughts on Rybakina, the runner up. So I can't quite figure her out, you know. Yeah, like I've criticized her in the past for like not being a great fighter, but I think that's wrong, because she like goes and wins all 3 setters, and then the one she loses is straight sets. Like it's weird because she has these spells of like seeming invincibility, a little bit like Iga, honestly. Sometimes when like she just plays and like behind that, you know, different games, but behind that serve, like, and the easy power, you're just like, what the hell can anyone do against this? And then she has spells where she looks really, really vulnerable. And I can't figure out the pattern. I don't, like, I know she's amazing, world's class tier one player, but then she has these early losses, like the Australian Open. Like, what are your reads on Rybakina? Because I feel like every single tournament mine gets like changed.
Yeah, it's like you look at the results this year, and she's like, she's won a couple of titles. Like outside the Australian Open, she's done really well, because she didn't play Indian Wells. She seems to get a lot of illnesses, a lot of ill health, and
yeah,
that's another thing where like her immune system, for whatever reason, like she's wearing these like recovery glasses throughout Miami, which I asked her about in the mix zone actually, and she's like, these glasses are not for fashion, they're for recovery. So oh, like wow. I put them on, and like, you know, I get like this sense of, I she didn't really elaborate because she didn't want to, like she didn't want to. Sure. Explain all that information, but like I felt like she wasn't at 100% throughout the whole week. Like she seemed to be struggling, like just managing her energy, and like you saw a lot of level dips, because like she'd be playing amazing and godlike for like a few games and hitting 3 or 4 aces sometimes and in 2 games, and then like her level would just dip. Like she lost that second set against Azarenka. She won 5 total points in that second set. You're just like, with a serve like yours, like how is that possible that you got bageled, you know? But I guess she was also just potentially conserving her energy for the third set. Because like when it really counted, she stepped up. But like in the final, I feel like she didn't quite have that gear, because she played so many 3 setters that physically I think it was too big of a gap between fresh and freshness, and how like Collins was so fresh and like so motivated, and like Rybakina at that point was just kind of on her last straw. And like she, like Collins, I think Rybakina was 1 for 11 on break points, because the match was even closer than like what the 5 and 3 suggests. It was like over 2 hours, and it was like could have like easily gone her way. But yeah, I feel like in future tournaments, like if she, because like also think because she missed Indian Wells, so like she was looking for that match rhythm earlier on. She didn't expect to get to the final. Like she said that she, like for her this is a great result because she thought okay like maybe quarters max is like my this is the best I'm gonna do here, and then get ready for the clay. So kind of unfortunate. Maybe if she had played Indian Wells, like maybe then maybe you know she would have felt a bit more of a favorite going into this one. But like yeah, she plays so many three setters, and that's probably like one area of her game like this year where it's just not quite as like she should be winning some of those matches a bit easier. Like forget the Sakari one, or like well I'll throw that one out of it, but like all the others I feel like she had a big like level dip at some point that just made her life a lot harder.
Yeah, I mean I agree with you, like in the sense like the 3, the 5, and 3 were was a lot more closer than it looked, especially like in the last game, like where she was playing. She wasn't necessarily it's not that I feel like Collins didn't necessarily choke in that game as opposed to Rybakina just like played some ridiculous shots as well, like and saving match points as well, getting to break points. He could have gone that game could have easily gone her way. It was just like I think they both were playing like extremely good tennis at that time. I do find that I like Rybakina's approach to being able to still let her lose and just go for the forehands as well. And most of the times, I think she makes those. And you know, she is pretty bold as well, like with her aggression. I like that she showed quite a bit of emotion on court this week. I kind of got a bit of a feel of like where she was at. I feel like she showed that she wasn't 100% like in their body language as well. Like sometimes she was a little frustrated with her level. But yeah, I think she, maybe you were right before Owen. I think that she wasn't necessarily the best fighter, but I think this might be something that she has been learned. She has been learning to do. I think it was just kind of like a skill that you can improve on, that it's not necessarily something that is so much related to technique as opposed to like a mentality or a focus thing. And I think that she may have lacked that in a few matches in the past, but like she's kind of like trying to feel like, well, I'm not gonna play 100%. I'm not gonna be peak me all the time. So it's something that she ended up like having to learn how to do. And I think that's a great skill, which is could probably set her up to be a lot more dangerous like in the over the course of the next few games as well. So yeah, and
watch out for Wimbledon.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the one where I feel like she would be like the most dangerous.
Yeah,
if she could definitely.
And the one thing about her that like always kind of surprised me a bit is how low her percentage is. It's always hovering about like 50%, 52%, sometimes like 49%. And I'm like, how? So, isn't there something that you can do to like bump it up to at least 60%? And like, I think if you could do this, if you don't like start just like rolling the ball in just for the sake of like percentages, like, but you know, like just trying to get in like a big serve, like in like more often, I think it could be huge for her. Like, I feel like it could even cover like what Marce said, like with a serve, like you were like, you shouldn't be getting big old, like ever. But yeah, I feel like that's something that there's always an area of their game that I'm always like a little bit impressed by. Like that is a very weirdly low serve percentage for a huge server, I guess.
Yeah. It's a great point, Andre. Like a tennis thing I'm always going to remember is I was at the Australian Open semi last year between Rybakina and Azarenka, and I remember that first set was like a real battle. Azarenka broke her twice and had like a low 40 at 5-all, but Rybakina wins it in a tiebreak. And I remember like looking up at the stats like after that first set, and like Rybakina had served at like 50%, and I remember thinking in that moment like this match is over because like she won that set and she wasn't even really out of like first or second gear. And yeah, like she won the second set much more comfortably, like 6-3, 8-2 breaks. And yeah, it's kind of amazing how like, I think maybe where the thought that she isn't a great fighter comes from is that like, I think she is at her best as a front runner, like when she can kind of win that first set while like kind of cruising. And then she picks up steam and just demolishes in the second set. Like kind of what she was on her way to doing against Iga a little while ago before Nida came back at her. Yeah, I think it's pretty interesting. I do think Wimbledon against that serve, it's going to be very hard. And I think that win last year that Ons Jabeur had against her from a set down is aging very, very well. But Yeah, I'm excited to see what she can do on clay as well. I want to see her play Iga again on clay, because that that Rome match that she won when Iga had to Iga couldn't finish. I would like to see another edition of that.
Yeah, I hope she can be 100% for all the clay tournaments, because last year she had to pull out of the Roland Garros and then she kind of didn't seem right like the whole rest of the year after that. Mm-hmm. After pulling out of, she had COVID, I think. So yeah, hopefully she can be in the mix, because like I feel like we have a really good group of like four or five top players right now in the WTA. I just like to see them play each other more often. That's like my only wish, like just get more matches between them. Hopefully we can get that during the next few months.
And about the clay season, which is about to start, I mean, I guess I think WTA sort of started in Charleston on the green clay, which is for me always like a little weird, but I don't know. I never played on the green clay. I only seen it. They had like some in Montreal in the Tennis Canada National Tennis Center. And it feels a little too dry for me. Like it doesn't necessarily look that I feel like the red clay that I'm used to in South America. But I don't give it a pass. It's clay is clay and that's it. But
like hard cube is what they call it in the States.
Yeah, exactly. But what was it going to say about it? Oh yeah, but like we have obviously like and WTA have Iga Świątek, like the super favorite for basically all the tournaments. What do you think should be challenging her the most, I guess? And on the men's side, who should be like the main guy to be like, you know, the favorite for the titles there?
Is it for Iga? For the women's?
For the women, like who's going to challenge Iga, and for the men's, who's going to be the big one, like the big player to beat?
I feel like for the women, the most challenging one for Iga is still going to be Madrid with the high altitude and like the one that's like the most outlier of the bunch with like the fast clay and the way it all. I feel like Sabalenka, if she's in the right frame of mind, that's a tournament she can do really well in and potentially get another win over Iga or win that one. And she even made the semis of Roland Garros last year. So like Sabalenka's been really, really good in the majors. Like
should have been in the final too.
Yeah, should have been in the final. Exactly. Like I agree. She should have been in that final. She was up 5-2 and had match point over Muhova. So honestly, like I feel like she can peak for the French Open again if she's like, you know, if everything, she can sort everything out in her life right now. Obviously, she's going through a tough time. But like honestly, Madrid, Rome, and Roland Garros, it'd probably be her, right? I mean, I can't think of anyone else right now who can challenge Iga like toe for toe. I guess I'm interested in Rybakina if they ever play each other. I guess Goff is another interesting one just because of, you know, Goff and Iga played each other like the last two times at Roland Garros, and Iga obviously has her number, but I feel like their match last year was a little bit closer than the year before that. So maybe like it's a time for Coco to get it. But honestly, Iga feels like an overwhelming favorite on the WTA, whereas on the men's it's much closer.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. I think Sabalenka is the challenger on the women's side. Like I do think like if I mean Iga's absolutely a favorite, but I do think like if it's a Roland Garros final between those two, like Sabalenka is like live in that matchup in a way that Goff is not, and I think that a lot of other players are not. So that's the one I want to see. I really hope that Sabalenka takes the time she needs to, you know, deal with losing someone that she was close to. And I hope that doesn't interfere with her level. But, you know, if it does, obviously completely understandable. And the men's, like, there's a bit of a vacuum without Rafa. And also with Djokovic. Like, Djokovic is not, he's great at Roland Garros and he's great at Rome. But, like, I'm not expecting Djokovic to do anything in Monte Carlo and maybe not even Madrid. Like, so there's a real opportunity for someone, for Alcaraz and Sinner to come in and just win everything. Like it's I don't think it's gonna happen because like they're both there in the way of each other and there are other players there too. But like there's an opportunity here for someone to come in and sort of like, I'm the next king of clay, you know? Like if let's say Sinner, we haven't seen Neo Sinner on clay yet, right? Like Gil Gross made that point in a video. Let's say he's still not adjusted on the clay. Alcaraz, that's a great opportunity. Go in there and just beat everyone, right? Like you've beaten Djokovic on clay before. You've made the Roland Garros semis. You're over the cramping issues that arguably cost you that match. Like there's a chance, right? Like and it's not going to happen just because like, you know, he's not Rafa. But I think that Alcaraz and Sinner really have a chance to kind of go in and sort of like stamp their authority on that surface. I think because like Djokovic, he may be declining, right? Like, we don't know, but he
no, for sure, but yeah, he's
but the way he started this year certainly hints at like the start of a decline, right? And so if he does if he does poorly at Roland Garros, I think then we can really start talking about it.
I think the Roland Garros result is what I'm going to put the most stock in for Djokovic.
Yeah, like, me too.
If there's really a decline, I'm going to point towards that, because I feel like the Olympics is like the main priority. Everyone knows that. The question is, does he play Wimbledon? Does he skip Wimbledon? You know,
like, that's he said he might.
Because like, he said he might do it, and like he's not sure about it. I feel like he's pretty 50-50, and he's split with his management team, his, you know, the agent and his wife. Like, they're not in the picture anymore, and then also Goran isn't in the picture. Yeah. So who's going to be his next coach? Is he going to even have a coach? How interesting, how motivated. He said he struggled with some motivation at the start of the year. And also he had the whole injury thing, the wrist issues in Australia. And then he got sick, never looked 100%. We still don't know what happened in that center match. Like, we still don't know like the full details, but we just know he wasn't like 100%. That was definitely not the Djokovic we're used to seeing. So I'd be very surprised if he just comes out of Monte Carlo, just full swing, full steam, and just looks like world beating Djokovic. I'd be pretty surprised. I mean, it could happen, but like...
Yeah, no, I didn't expect like a sequel to that loss to Nardi, really, because because he lost to Dan Evans in Monte Carlo, like, and he lost to Musetti there last year, right? Like, from a setup, even, was it? Like, I think...
6-4, 4-2 up. It was a very...
Right, so... My expectations are low for him there. At the same time, I agree with Yvonne. Like, Roland Garros is... Yeah, sorry. But I want to see Djokovic play Alcaraz or Sinner at Roland Garros, because I think that will give us the answer of, like, if... I think if he, like, loses comfortably in four sets, yeah, we can start saying, like, he's lost, I don't know, 2% or whatever. But if he if he wins, then, you know, he's at all as good as ever. What we've been saying, like, every year for the past billion years. So that's the matchup I want to see him against one of those two.
The real question is what we're going to do when Medvedev wins Rome again.
It's going to be the rest of the year. He won Rome last year, but that's a very much an outlier kind of
story. Oh, yeah, no, yeah. But you and me.
For him, the main issue for Medvedev right now is he's playing great. He deserves to be in the top four, but what is he going to do with Alcaraz and Sinner and Novak? Because those three matches... lost 14 of his last 16 every time he's faced those three. And it's really rough for him, because he's getting to all these semis and finals. And now, you know, the Sinner matchup has really turned on a dime. Like, this was an absolute beatdown. You know, this was like, he had no clue what... I've never seen him look that befuddled on a court. Maybe when he played Nadal in 2019 Montreal, that's like the last time he's ever lost a scoreline that one-sided, completely unheard of. Like, because at least when Sinner beat him those other four times, you know, it was close, it was interesting, they had some ups and downs. You know, I feel like he came up with the same strategy that he tried to do in the Australian Open and just play a ton more aggressive, only this time he made a bazillion more unforced errors. And Sinner was just ready for it in a way that he wasn't in the first two sets of AO. So now the question is, like, he has a big adjustment to make, to where he actually should probably go back to playing a little bit more conservatively from the baseline, but at the same time fix the return position. And yeah, it's going to be very interesting on clay, though. I don't know, like, he's probably still like a top eight guy, but probably not like, you know, 4 through 8. Like, he's probably at the bottom of that tier. But like, the main guy I'm really interested in is Runa, because Runa made the final of Monte Carlo where he should have won. And then he was in the final of Rome where I also thought he probably should have won. So now all of a sudden, and basically, like, he hasn't been like kind of the same since Roland Garros last year, where Casper Ruud, like, you know, just came out and beat him and destroyed him in the first two sets.
That was a weird, like, that Runa's one where I'm like, I don't know what's happened to him, but I mean, and I don't want to go too long on this. Sorry, Andre, I'll let you go on a sec. But like, Medvedev, even I agree with you, Vance, like, probably needs to be a bit more conservative, but like, we've seen where that gets him too, right? Like, they split sets and then he gets worn down in the third set. So like, that's either like
four different ways that Sinner has beaten him now in like five meetings.
Exactly.
Yeah, and he's not... as good as Medvedev is, he's not like he doesn't have that kind of toolbox. Like, he doesn't have that many weapons. So it's not a thing where that you can say with Alcaraz where it's like, oh, try this, try that. You have everything. Like, Medvedev doesn't have everything. Mm-hmm. He might not have an answer here. I don't know how he center again.
Yeah.
He just totally outserves him, which like Yannick totally outserved him in this one, which I mean, just cannot happen if you're Medvedev. So
yeah. I think Bruno should fire Marta Blue first start.
I think everyone should fire him.
Yeah.
But honestly, I feel like his best results have come with Muratoglu. That's the strange thing. Like, all of his best results have come with Patrick.
Well,
are his worst results also coming with Muratoglu now, though? Because it's like, And then
saying like I probably shouldn't have played this tournament and like this thing. He forgot to say congratulations, Morojan. But anyway, that's, I thought that was a funny tweet.
Yeah, I don't know what to feel about Rune right now. I feel like at this point, you should just kind of like put him in the back of my mind as like wait and see like what happens. Like just not, I won't count him out, but I also won't be like, you know, asking too much of him at every tournament right now. Just like okay, like let's just see what happens with this guy. Like next time he makes a big semi or wins a big match, I'm gonna be like okay, maybe I should start focusing on him a little bit more now. And yeah, see what happens. But yeah, Medvedev to win Roland Garros, and yeah, thanks guys so much for showing up. And Owen, Vonish, I meant to say, Vonish, thanks for finding the time to finally be in the podcast again. I know you've been extremely busy. The tennis world is fast and takes a lot of time. So yeah, it's great to have all of us three again in the same pod. I think last time was probably somewhere in November that we did it. But it's yeah,
humble, you know, so yeah, I'm really happy the three of us could do this again.
100%. Yeah. Owen,
not wait that long there, so.
Owen, congratulations already on boxing. It's maybe tennis is gonna come soon, wink wink. Let's hope that we can have energy to keep watching some tennis as the clay season is starting, like maybe they're gonna start fresh again. Thanks so much for all the listeners. We took a while to post this one, but thanks so much for, you know, waiting and listening again. And you can do the same usual, find all of our links on the description. You can also find, as Vosh said, Tennis One app in the description of this episode. And is it Iga and Carlos podcast? Is that one thing?
Carlos, Iga and Carlos Tennis Show. So you can follow us on Twitter at Iga Carlos Tennis.
Yeah.
It's available on Spotify, Apple, and all that jazz.
Yeah,
You need to have us as guests on that. Like, let's benefit from some nepotism here.
We haven't actually considered like having a ton of guests yet. We're in the works, but like we'll definitely keep you. I'll definitely keep you guys in mind for sure.
Nice. Hear that, Andre? We're kept in mind. That's
We're kept in mind in the mind of a great tennis professional. You can follow us.
Excited when we saw that Daria Abramovich now follows us.
So,
nice. Kudos. Well, anyways, follow us at Tennis and Bagels official. Is it official? I don't even know anymore. I haven't used the account too much in the past few months. Then find us at Tennis and Bagels on Twitter. Owen is at Tennis Nation, Vansh is at Vansh2K. And I am at Rolenberg. Andre, we'll see you guys later. Thank you so much. Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.